Hi, everybody. I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon. We want to announce the publication of One True Sentence, Writers and Readers on Hemingway's Art by Michael and me. The introduction is by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. That is coming out by Godin in July of 2022. So please see onetruepod.com for more information, or you can pre-order it at your favorite bookseller. Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino, and my producer is Michael Von Cannon. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Today's show is part of our popular series in which we take Hemingway at his own premise. We ask our guest a very simple question, her choice for Hemingway's one true sentence and why. And then, as Hemingway instructs, we go on from there. We are delighted to welcome Jennifer Haig. Jennifer Haig's first novel, Mrs. Kimball, won the Penn Hemingway Award for debut fiction in 2004. Since then, she has published five more books, most recently Heat and Light, which won a literature award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters and was named a best book of 2016 by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and NPR. Thank you so much for joining us, Jennifer.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
So what is your one true sentence and why?
Okay. My sentence is from the story Mr. and Mrs. Elliot that was published in Hemingway's first collection In Our Time. The sentence is, they tried as often as Mrs. Elliot could stand it. And to unpack a little bit about why this sentence is so great, I'm going to give you the context. I'm going to give you the paragraph that is, in fact, the second sentence of the story. The first sentence is this. Mr. and Mrs. Elliot tried very hard to have a baby. They tried as often as Mrs. Elliot could stand it. They tried in Boston after they were married, and they tried coming over on the boat. They did not try very often on the boat because Mrs. Elliot was quite sick. She was sick, and when she was sick as Southern women are sick, that is, women from the southern part of the United States. Like all Southern women, Mrs. Elliot disintegrated very quickly under seasickness, traveling at night and getting up too early in the morning. Many of the people on the boat took her for Elliot's mother. Other people who knew they were married believed she was going to have a baby. In reality, she was 40 years old. Her years had been precipitated suddenly when she started traveling. So this one true sentence, they tried as often as Mrs. Elliot could stand it, comes very early in this story that is really a forensic examination of a young, ill-advised marriage. And the story goes on to unpack the relationship between this very unlikely young husband and significantly older wife. What I find remarkable about the sentence and about the story in general is the use of point of view. This story is recounted in this kind of distant voice that tells you the facts of the story as the people involved understand them and as they relay them to each other. So this narrative voice does not question the veracity of any of the official version of this marriage. The voice simply reports, this is how this marriage has unfolded. And as the story progresses, you come to see that there are fundamental fissures in this marriage that neither the husband nor the wife talks about or perhaps can articulate. But what we are given is the official version of events, how things happen, and the official explanation for why.
So that's a fascinating sentence and a fascinating story to choose. And I think one of the points that you're making about this sentence is that it calls to mind Hemingway's famous objectivity in narration. And then as you read, you were alluding to this, Jennifer, as you're reading the story, you're wondering how objective is is this narrator really? Does he tip his hand? Is his tongue in cheek? What is his level of true objectivity?
Oh, the voice is very knowing, and you sense that this voice knows much more than it is telling you. It's simply telling you the official version of events without analysis, without judgment, without theorizing or speculating as to the truth of any of the facts. And as this voice sort of tells us the facts of how this couple get together, as modern readers, we draw other conclusions about the motivations of Mr. and Mrs. Elliot. And you sense that the author also has questions about their motivations, but none of that is included in the story proper.
Yeah. So as a writer, I'm wondering how you negotiate that balance, because with Hemingway, it's always a discussion between what is revealed and what is omitted, his iceberg principle of writing. How do you, first of all, as a Hemingway reader, how do you respond to his theory of omission? And then how do you enact that as a writer?
I think it's Hemingway's great strength that he gives the reader a lot of credit. You know, there's never an attempt to interpret things for the reader. He leaves that to the reader and trusts that the reader will figure it out on her own. There is, especially in these early stories, there's very little internality as such. You know, we're not getting the character's thoughts as they think them, but rather as these characters might tell the story themselves. So implicitly, we're not inside these people's heads. We're simply hearing the story as they would tell it. And as a writer, I think I've gone through several cycles of this. Early on, when I was very influenced by Hemingway, there was very little internality in my own early stories as well. And it was a thing that I had learned from him. And I think it was, for me as a young writer, a really important lesson. I do feel that I did not know how to write a sentence until I read Hemingway. And I do think if you look at 20th century American literature, he had a cauterizing effect on the way fiction writers wrote sentences. If you look at what predates Hemingway, a writer like Thomas Wolfe, there is a fulsome quality to those sentences that Hemingway, as a young writer especially, cut right through. And I think it had a remarkable clarifying effect on language generally. We all write differently because Hemingway wrote.
What you learned from Hemingway about writing a sentence is clarity and directness.
Yes.
I guess Mr. and Mrs. Elliot comes into that directness. First of all, with your sentence, but also in the first sentence of the story, Mr. and Mrs. Elliot tried very hard to have a baby. Well, although that's a very simple sounding sentence, when I read that sentence, I realize I'm not sure how frequently it's described that way, that you've tried very hard to have a baby. And this is, of course, repeated over and over through the story. So are the characters being mocked by the narrator, pitied by the narrator, or is he just presenting their activity?
He's presenting their activity as they would themselves render it. And I think there is a real stealth humor in this story. It's completely subterranean. There's nothing overt about it. He's never disrespectful toward the characters. But there is implicit comedy in some of their difficulties. And you sense that the narrative voice is very much aware of this. You also see it when he talks about other people's reactions to this odd marriage. I love this sentence. His mother cried when he brought Cornelia home after their marriage, but brightened very much when she learned they were going to live abroad. And so there's no unpacking of why the mother cried or why she might have been relieved that they were going to move far away. It's simply stated that this was her position.
Yeah. And then at the end of the story, they had many a good cry together, which means something altogether different, right?
The story ends very wonderfully with what I think is sort of an uncharacteristically complex sentence for the young Hemingway. And the final sentence is, In the evening, they all sat at dinner together in the garden under a plane tree, and the hot evening wind blew, and Elliot drank white wine, and Mrs. Elliot and the girlfriend made conversations, and they were all very happy.
Yeah. What I note about that sentence is the way that Hemingway uses the word and, which, I mean, he's as good, at least as good as anybody else at using the word and. A little bit earlier in the story, there's that sentence, he did not like to waken her, and soon everything was quite all right, and he slept peacefully. Well, there's a lot going on in those ands, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. He's also really good at the but. So in that same paragraph.
Right.
This is about the couple's wedding night. They were both disappointed, but finally Cornelia went to sleep.
Yes. But. That's mm-hmm. good.
Yeah.
It was possible to try to have a baby, but Cornelia could not attempt it very often, although they wanted a baby more. That but and although doing, yeah, in that same sentence.
Lots and lots of work in those two words.
Back after this. This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I are huge fans of the Hemingway Review. We always read it to see the latest scholarship. You can buy back issues of the Hemingway Review at hemingwaysociety.org/journals. Thinking about the books that you've written and your writing career, are there times where it really is one true sentence that galvanizes an entire project or it gives you inspiration, even one of your own true sentences?
Yes, I think that is most clear to me in a first draft where you really do, or I really do, write them sentence by sentence. And my friend Andre Debuse says that the next sentence always lies in the last sentence you wrote. And it's really just, it's following a chain. And if I truly believe in Hemingway's mantra, if you write a true sentence, then you go on from there. You know, that a true sentence will lead to another true sentence.
So doesn't that make the first sentence of the novel of utmost importance?
It is. And yet you almost never get it on the first go, or I don't. You know, part of the difficulty of writing a first draft is knowing that much of what you're writing is wrong, and that a lot of it is going to have to be thrown away. And so it's hard to proceed with that knowledge that what you've just put down might not, what you think is the first paragraph will almost certainly not be the first paragraph of the novel. But you must keep going in order to get to the good stuff, you know? So sometimes you have to write through some sentences that are not true. And so, you know, this is the danger of Hemingway's dictum, you know, if you take it too much to heart.
Right.
And you can endlessly question the truth of the sentence you've just written and never get to sentence two.
So let's talk about the word truth, and you said not true, and what is a true, how can a sentence be true or false?
I think it's really a question of exactitude, and it's not qualifying to make things gentler, you know, it's not modifying endlessly to convey these kind of modulations of tone. And this is a thing that I was very aware of myself as a young writer, that I tended to soften things. And I see this when I'm teaching, and often in young female students. And I think it has something to do with, you know, girls are raised to please. And I know that's a gross generalization, but it certainly has been true in my own history that, you know, I had been trained from birth to put things delicately and diplomatically. And that can get in the way of writing a true sentence. Absolutely. You know, that you try so hard to convey these small gradations of meaning so as not to make the truth too upsetting or objectionable to anybody. And really, you can modify yourself right out of writing anything true ever.
What's the relationship, if any, between that kind of modification that you're talking about and the iceberg principle, where if you omit something that you aren't intending to say or convey without actually coming right out and saying it, and you're talking about something that seems to be related but a little bit different, do you see any kind of connection between those two things?
Mm. Well, the connection I see really is between modifiers and verbs, you know, and it's because I was teaching creative writing this semester. It's something that is fresh in my mind, the way young writers tend to rely excessively on adverbs, not understanding that if you need to put an adverb in that sentence, that in some way your verb is lacking, you know. She said with a certain je ne sais quoi, you know, it's, I mean, really. So you see this sometimes with students where they write these fabulously elaborate adverbs and adverbial clauses. And it's really just because they've not found the right verb that the bones of the sentence are not strong enough.
Yeah. So I was thinking about Hemingway's particular attention to speech tags or lack thereof. And the kind of, you said it very well, that he trusts the reader, right? And maybe some of your students don't have that level of self-trust at this stage. But when Hemingway just says, kiss me again like that, she said, and it's up to the reader to figure out how it was said. And then you read something like The Great Gatsby, where it's like, can't repeat the past, he cried incredulously. Mm-hmm. Well, is incredulously, you know, are you going to circle that and say that's too much? Or are you going to say congratulations on writing the most famous line in the great American novel?
It's hard for me to quibble with anything in Gatsby, I will tell you. And any sort of pronouncement I can make about writing that novel, you know, probably violates. And yet I that's a novel I read once a year. You know, it is so very dear to my heart and I so admire it. And I don't understand how you do that. I mean, certainly that is a novel that defies any rule you might try to lay down about writing. But what I do find, with the very simple dialogue tags you see in Hemingway, it's because he trusts the truth of the dialogue he has written. You know, often what I'll see in my own bad first drafts or in other writers' bad first drafts is that you write a completely inadequate line of dialogue and then you feel the need to apply a lot of stage directions that if you say this just the right way, it will seem meaningful. And generally that means you haven't done a good enough job writing that line of dialogue. And if the dialogue is good enough, it needs no further explanation, like that terrific line you quoted, kiss me that way again. You know, it doesn't matter how she said it. You know what it meant.
Yes, that's right. And if you're a writer who is writing in that style, are you at peace knowing that readers will have a range of interpretations and they'll hear it a number of different ways within a given scope?
I don't think they will if you get the dialogue right. And that is also a question of writing the true sentence. If you get the dialogue exactly right, it's so revelatory, it's so meaningful that there's no other way it can be taken. And I think until you have closed in on the precise effect you're trying to get in the words that are spoken, then it matters how the line is spoken.
So you find in your drafts, in your editing stages, that you're paring down and you're removing language, or are you adding and clarifying?
I more often have to add because I tend to underwrite everything. The first draft of Mrs. Kimball was 55 pages long and it was the whole story. And I thought I was done. I'd not written a novel before. I'd only written short stories. And that was the longest thing I'd ever written. And I could not imagine how that novel could be longer than 55 pages. And of course, it ended up being much longer than that, but it took me 9 drafts to get there. And it was because I needed to put flesh on the bone. And really, writing Mrs. Kimball was, for me, the process of teaching myself how to write a novel. The resolution, and I'm speaking in photographic terms, the resolution of a scene is entirely different in a novel as in a short story. You know, in a novel, it's much more granular. You slow down, you write the weather. And in a short story, it begins a minute before it ends. And, you know, it needs to have this kind of narrative tension that propels it forward. So there isn't room for that kind of texturizing you're doing in a novel. In a novel, you're trying to reproduce the texture of everyday life. And a short story isn't concerned with doing that. That's not your mission at all as a short story writer. So it's really, there's no way to teach yourself how to write a novel except by writing a novel. And for me, it took 9 drafts and lots of adding more flesh on the bone.
Do you respond more to Hemingway's short stories than his novels?
You know, it depends on, it depends. There have been, cycles in my own writing life where I, gravitated toward the novels. At the moment, I'm in a short story phase and, I'm revisiting the short stories more often than the novels, but I imagine that will shift again over time. And, you know, part of what, I revere about this work is that you can come back to it 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later, and still be moved by it in a way that is maybe wholly different from the way you initially were.
A case in point is Mr. and Mrs. Elliot, which I hadn't thought about in a while. And that what got me thinking about is some of the gender issues that Hemingway puts in that story. Do you have any thoughts about Hemingway in the 21st century? I mean, do you think there seems like there's a lot about Hemingway that our modern culture and social discourse might object to, particularly in areas of gender, but also race and anti-Semitism and so forth. Do you have any, is Hemingway still relevant and crucial to read?
Yes, I absolutely think so. I mean, certainly in one of the things a writer does is mirror the time in which you live, and he does do that. And so you do see prevailing attitudes about race, about gender, no question. And I think it is worthy to engage with those questions. At the same time, he also has a really acute psychological sense that remains relevant today. And I think this story is a terrific example. You know, this unlikely marriage between Mr. and Mrs. Elliot is really, you know, you can transpose this to a contemporary context pretty easily.
Yeah.
In fact, and the way the story ends with Mrs. Elliot's girlfriend living with the couple and the three of them living quite happily, it is in many ways a sort of a radical idea of marriage. And so, you know, I don't consider Hemingway old fashioned. I think he does, as a writer, have blind spots, as we all do. You know, we are all creatures of our time. And I'm sure I, as a writer, have blind spots that will be very apparent to readers 50 years from now that I don't see at all at the moment.
Would you mind rereading the sentence for us?
Certainly. They tried as often as Mrs. Elliot could stand it.
Jennifer Haig, thank you so much for joining us on One True Podcast. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Mark.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode is available on onetruepod.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Our show is supported by the Hemingway Society, the English Department at the University of Evansville, and Florida Gulf Coast University. Please also visit us on patreon.com/onetruepodcast for One True Book Club, our monthly book club where we read along with the young Ernest Hemingway. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast.